Hello and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host Matt Kuhlman, and my guest this episode is Anthony Montori. Anthony earned an Associate's in Arts degree from the Hudson Valley Community College in 2007, then completed his BFA at the Montserrat College of Art in 2009, and earned his MFA at the School of Museum of Fine Arts in Boston in 2012. Beginning as a painter, Anthony turned his focus to creating art in a video game format in recent years. His games use simple objectives and the blocky style of early 8-bit games. They're often designed as a test of the user's endurance in the face of difficult, and sometimes impossible, odds of success. Join me as he discusses creating art in such an atypical medium and where the inspiration for a fine art video game comes from. Hi Anthony, how are you doing today?
Great.
Thanks for being here with me.
Yeah.
So, I think the most striking difference between you and other artists is you use a very unique medium. And so how long have you been working in a video game platform to create your work, and how did that come about?
Well, it's actually not been too long. I just learned how to write code, and albeit very rudimentarily. I took a class in the spring of 2011 called Art.net Intro to Hacking with Steve Lambert, and the class description sounded like we were just going to be breaking things open and like figuring out how they work and making them do the things we didn't, you know, they shouldn't do, and it turns out that we were essentially just going to go through this, you know, intro to Java book called Learning Processing. Processing is essentially a kind of shell over Java, so It's designed for artists, and so I started learning that, and I realized that I could make video games with it, and so since it's been about a year and a half, I've just been, just totally focused on that.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing before you started making video games?
Before that, I was I wasn't really sure what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I was working kind of just out of my head, you know, in any real medium that I felt was applicable to the project I had in mind. I would work sculpturally one day, drawings the next. I was doing a lot of painting even before that. Always kind of conceptually based, and really always about around ideas of futility and failure and just
failures or expressions of failure.
Yeah, I think it was mostly about things related, especially to a kind of institutional or art practice critique. Mm-hmm. But you know, projects that would manifest themselves around those ideas. Very, very one-liner, very kind of self-aware, and you know, it just wasn't really making a lot of sense. So, But yeah, that's kind of what I was doing before.
What are some examples of pieces that you made?
There's one on the wall right here. That's probably a decent example.
Like a partially completed jigsaw puzzle.
A partially completed jigsaw puzzle with a photo of Nicolas Beaurard, a contemporary art philosopher and curator, kind of a jet setter figure in the art world, writes a little bit of theory and stuff about globalization and things like that, and we were reading his texts in classes, and I was, you know, I was really into it, and I was thinking, this is also, by the way, a performance class, so I should mention that performance definitely was something that was on my mind then. So I had this puzzle made of a photo of him on a yacht, which kind of undermines his theories. And
Where'd you get the photo from? You
just found it on Google. Yeah, I found the photo on Google, and I just went online and found a shop that made custom puzzles. I just sent them the photo and had the puzzle printed. And so I took the puzzle pieces in the class unfinished, and you know, I asked everyone who was there to help me in about an hour's time complete this puzzle as best we could. And it was just a mess, but we did, you know, we did what we could. And when that hour was up, I threw away the pieces we hadn't found their places for. And that kind of picture on the wall, this unfinished puzzle, became the work. And it's interesting because, you know, it's only his face. It's kind of these mm-hmm. the edges in his face were the only things that really
it seems like they got all the flesh portions. They got his arms and his
exactly
face.
The kind of the things that are, you know, the easiest to recognize as a human being right mm-hmm. away were completed. And you know, so that's something that it's not it's really hard to kind of for me find some kind of typical example of everything that I was doing, but that certainly I think kind of fills in some of the blanks of where my thought process was at the time.
Mm. What are some of this person's ideas? I'm not familiar with them at all. Or
well,
how they relate to what you were doing.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've really thought about them, but you know, he's one of those people who I think is definitely trying to denounce or call into question the postmodern conversation that we've had for the last however many years, 40 years or so, 50 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, kind of say that that's dead, and that, you know, it wasn't really anything other than modernism, essentially, and that now that we're in this globalized art context where communication and the internet and all these other things have basically flattened out locality and distance, that we should become these kinds of we should become these nomadic artists, basically, that are capable of working in any context, or at least capable of understanding themselves as, you know, not specific to any region, not an artist from this area, or not an artist who does this, but who is just a kind of meandering, wandering person who listens to, you know, regional culture, who listens to that and kind of creates this global cultural narrative.
Okay.
So that's that's kind of his. I mean, I'm probably butchering it, but you know, that's kind of what I've taken away from it, at least now, in the last few years of thinking about it.
Is that something that plays in at all to your current work, working in the digital sphere like that?
No, not so much. It's almost like I've kind of regressed. instead of working in any medium and thinking about, you know, any context not trying to define myself in any particular way, I've now just gone full circle and said, you know what, I make video games now.
Mm-hmm.
So so I don't know, maybe it did influence me and I'm reacting against it or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, I think that work, especially digital work like this, becomes capable of being transmitted and broadcast to an incredibly wide audience, where it doesn't have to be displayed in a gallery, it doesn't have to be consumed that way. So it can be experienced by tons of people across the globe if at the very least they have an internet connection.
Mm-hmm.
So
what are some other pieces that you might have done before you started working in video games? I'm just curious to know about it, because it sounds like you were working with the same ideas, and I wonder how they would have played out in a traditional
sense. I can say that, I mean, when I was, I can give you a bit, little bit of history. I mean, I went to, so in terms of school, I went to Hudson Valley Community College for 3 years to get my associates in fine arts. And there, you know, I wasn't really making art. I was just learning the, you know, the basics of seeing and stuff, you know, painting and drawing and, mm-hmm. and photography and things like that. And then I went to Montserrat College of Art to finish out and get my BFA. And there I was kind of focused solely on painting as a conceptual practice, so kind of like making the same abstract painting over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And giving myself rules for its completion based on kind of arbitrary number sets, like my favorite album and like how long the songs were on that album, and like kind of abstraction as this arbitrary act of autonomous art production, so I was like playing with that, and that's but you know, I mean, that was still undergrad work, and I was just like kind of reacting against the scene there, thinking about how to play with that. And then, you know, I finished there, and even then in my thesis show I had paintings, but I stuffed a Nintendo 64 in the middle of them just to kind of confuse, you know, the read. So
it was like an abstract painting with a realistic painting of a 64 in the middle? Or?
No, it was actually an actual Nintendo 64 that people could play.
Okay.
stuffed in the middle of this art installation that had like a video piece and a few paintings.
Okay.
And you were supposed to look at the paintings and kind of try to avoid the Nintendo 64 as this kind of high art, low art dichotomy. And all that happened were people were playing
Everybody
Nintendo 64. Exactly.
Nintendo.
So I was, but it was secretly what I wanted. I wanted to kind of...
Was there a selection of games or one game?
There were a handful. There were Mario Kart was kind of in there.
Gotta have that one.
Exactly, it was in there on default, so that was pretty much the only game that stayed in the console.
Mm.
But you know, I had other games, you know, not just multiplayer games. So I had Mario Kart as this like, you know, convivial like group thing where like if three or four people were in the gallery, they could all play together and waste an hour doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also had like Zelda game. So
yeah.
there could be this personal exploration, this personal adventure. But those games were kind of just affixed to the wall, and I don't know if people understood that they could take out the other one and put the other one in. It
mm-hmm.
kind of became this big drawing on the wall. The Nintendo 64 was actually installed on the wall. The games were installed on the wall. The wiring and stuff was kind of arranged in this zigzag pattern that led back down to the outlets.
Okay.
So it kind of became this drawing / Nintendo 64 art installation. And to play the games, you actually got in the way of the viewing area of the other work, the paintings and the video.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was...
That didn't stop anybody.
Nope, didn't stop anybody. It just frustrated the people who wanted to look at the other work. And so that was also kind of, you know, an act of performance art, for sure. I was just then starting to get interested in performance.
Mm-hmm.
Only ever really understood it, you know, through history, through what I had read and stuff. So I wanted to actually try it. And so that's what I went into the SMFA with, was a kind of understanding of performance art, like, as my next step, like, as what I wanted to try next. And so I, you know, I pretty much immersed myself in that theory and took all these classes in performance art. And that's pretty much where my work was. So I was doing all kinds of things around that, but around the idea of play. So I hosted a Box Wars event. I don't know if you've heard of Box Wars, but it's where these, you know, people will just dress up in cardboard box armor with swords and just go at each other for like an hour and just hit each other with these things. And I was like, you know, I was seeing videos of people doing this at music events, in large fields out in the country, and I was like, well, why can't this happen in a performance room or an art context? So I was just like, there's nothing that needs to be changed here. I just laid a bunch of cardboard down on the ground, and I showed people a video of what I had in mind, and I said, go to, you know, get at it, and we all dressed up, and we had, you know, a lot of fun, and it was really interesting way to relieve a lot of tension that people were having, and I think it was things like that were kind of effective. So, you know, it was this kind of performance, definitely a performance art piece, but one that didn't really look like performance art and was kind of coming from an almost outsider's perspective on play and performance. And so that's what I think where the video game started to come in. It was like, well, I don't even need the live, you know, people in a room aspect. I can just make a game and make it about play.
And so let's get into some of the specific games that you made and
sure. What
goes into them. And
So the first game that I worked on was... It was for a project where we had to make a game based on, or actually not even a game, make a program for this class that I took,
mm-hmm.
Based on either our favorite book or a book we had just read. and I had just read Camus' Myth of Sisyphus. And so I was like, well, that would make a really great game. You know, you just tap the button, the boulder goes up the hill, falls back down, and like, that's it. And, you know, that's kind of what most video games and most human action is like. So I set out to make this really basic game called, I think it was called back then, it was called, Sisyphus or something like that, or just like, but now it's, you know, now it's called The Adventures of Sisyphus. So over about 8 months, I just worked on that game alone.
Mm-hmm.
Learned everything I could, learned how to make a score system, learned how to make the graphics look better. I learned how to, just really get comfortable writing code and programming. And when I kind of felt comfortable with that, I moved on to a game called Rags. A friend of mine, was doing a show called Painter's Rags and Other Artists' Clothing, where, you know, she's a tailor, and so her focus is on how people utilize clothing and how clothing is created and what clothing means to people and what clothing means to artists. And the idea was that, you know, she wanted people to bring in and display the clothes that they make as an artist or wear when they're working. And my argument was that I work and make constantly in my head, and I'm thinking all the time about my projects. So I decided to digitize my entire wardrobe and make a video game.
So those were all actually clothes that you own?
Yeah. Yeah.
Visually manifest in the game.
I had to go through my entire wardrobe and kind of draw out in Photoshop a very rough, basic, recreation of that piece of clothing, and then give it two or three frames for running and
mm-hmm.
all these other things. So by the end, I have 500, I think, clothing assets for the game.
Mm-hmm.
But so what you can do is dress up.
I remember there's a lot of different things you can
wear.
It's like to the point that you can't even see most of it.
Well,
because it's all
funny.
Covered up.
Yeah, it's some of the things get covered. I mean, like, you can dress me in underwear and that's it. But the second you put on pants, like, it doesn't really matter what choice
mm-hmm.
you made. But that's the funny thing that happened was when I first showed it, what became everyone's favorite clothing configuration was one t-shirt, and that was it. So it was just a t-shirt and just the bottom half
no
of
pants.
Me completely naked. Right, so, but that was the idea, was that was where the fun was to be had, was that,
mm-hmm.
like, for this show, for this piece, I didn't really care that it was a video game. It wasn't really about the video game, it was about this idea that when people play games, they want to customize this character, they want to be in control of what this character looks like. But when the character is not them, and when the character can't be changed in any other way than the clothing that they're wearing, I think I found that it was really kind of, that was where the fun lied. Like, people could, they would spend more time dressing me and trying to figure out what clothing they wanted to put on me than actually playing the game that I had made for the choices they had made after that, where that, the game was kind of pointless. It was just like Sisyphus.
As I remember, you can't succeed.
Yeah, exactly. You can't do anything.
You can't reach the coins.
Nope.
And you reach a chasm that you can't jump and then
exactly.
you die.
Yeah, once you've dressed me, you're basically left to wander around this, I called it the Rags Wasteland, with these coins floating just out of reach.
Mm.
And every time you try to jump for one, you essentially kill yourself. So I later made that about trying to get funding for art projects, because
yeah.
I was having a hard time finding money for these arcades that I eventually built for my my graduate thesis. But the futility aspect was definitely a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of obviously undermining the fact that, you know, it's a video game, but it's really like a character menu selection screen at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, maybe it speaks something to my personality, but I just felt compelled to like make every selection, no matter how pointless it was, because it was
right.
like undershirt, vest, coat, scarf, like, now you can't see any of it.
Yeah, and if you dress me like completely like that, like if you go the whole end and just cover me up. Like, it doesn't look right. Like,
yeah.
This is weird, like, you know, everything is in its place, but, like, I would never actually wear those many clothes. So after that, I went into full-on graduate thesis mode and started working on the games that I set out to have for that show. So the next idea I had in mind was, it was Into the Void with Eve Klein, which is not a game you can find online, unfortunately. This game is heavily focused around the high score system that I still haven't been able to figure out and get online yet, but I wanted to make a game that was focused on just this one sliver of art history of this figure that I find really interesting but don't really understand completely.
Mm-hmm.
Eve Klein. And I've always been fascinated by that photo of him leaping into the void.
Yeah.
And if somebody listening is not aware, just look it up. It's really easy to find on Google. But
yeah, he's essentially like jumping onto the sidewalk, basically. But in that instant, it looks like he's flying.
Yeah, exactly. And it's this like really convincing photo manipulation where it looks like he's basically killing himself or jumping off this building. And you know it's safe. You know that it's not real, but it looks real, and it's a very interesting piece of art, I think. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be really funny if that was a video game? And wouldn't it be really funny if, like, it was kind of this over-the-top, ridiculous video game in the ways that, you know, a lot of serious video games actually are? So you start off as Eve Klein jumping around on rooftops looking for the void. And you run into Duchamp dressed up as Eros C'est la Vie. And he knows all about the void because he's Duchamp.
He is the void.
Yeah, and like Duchamp just is. He just seems like this all-knowing person. So, so you talk to him, and he explains to you how the game works. Because this first part where you're jumping around on the roofs is really not the game. The game starts when you leap into the void.
Mm-hmm.
And so after Duchamp tells you what to do, you come over to the edge of the building, just like in the photo, and you jump off. And the portal opens up, and so basically this like kind of fantasy logical conclusion of this photograph is realized, and the void opens up, swallows you, and now you're in the game, and all what you have to do is avoid being spat back out of the void.
Mm-hmm.
So that involves quite a bit of dexterity on the player's part, in that they have to avoid these rips or these tears in the void's fabric, and if they
mm-hmm.
can do that for a long enough period of time, they can stay in the void longer, but that's really it. There's no reward for staying in for more than 3 minutes. There's really no
Are they just constantly racking up points the longer they're in the void?
Basically, there's a timer, and
mm-hmm.
the high score system is based around who can stay in for longer.
Okay.
You can kind of work the game. One of the interesting features of the game is that you can pass through these tears, but as long as you're pressing a certain button, you'll be fine. And this is, I referred to this as the judo roll, because Eve Klein, I guess, was a judo master.
Okay.
And so he's...
Did not know that about him.
Yeah. I only found that out right before I had made the game, too. And I was like, wow, I can use that for something. That's interesting. And it sounds, you know, like that would be... It would have been perfect. I think in judo, one of the basic tenets of judo is that, you know, you're... And believe me, I really don't know what I'm talking about when I say that one of the basic tenets of judo is this, but I think it is that, you know, you use the power of your stronger opponent against them.
Mm, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, you know, you avoid exerting power or energy yourself and... you know, use it against your opponent. So their energy, I'm saying, against
mm-hmm.
your opponent. And so I just figured that, you know, it'd be a really interesting way to make it so that the character could avoid. So he basically just rolls out of the way and uses the kind of void tears as like a way to stay in for longer.
Mm-hmm.
And when you fail at this, you're spat back out and hit the ground, and you land in a bloody pulp, which eventually happens. There's no way to beat this game. You will always fail at it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can immortalize yourself essentially in this high score system by staying in for a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, at the opening, though, I found that most people found that 30 seconds or so was the most they could handle.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually still hold the high score
nice.
At about 5 minutes or so. So
I was curious, how long do people typically play these games, like the Sisyphus game, which I played, where you just repeatedly mash a button, like you said, and you get the... There's a little blurb of encouragement at the top, like, you're almost there,
yeah.
about to make it, and then, right when you get to the top, it falls back down. Like, do people generally stop at that point?
I think so, yeah. I think they give it one push, and that's that. I found that a lot... The two older games, Sisyphus and Rags, because they're so... so much about a kind of cyclical loop of failure and of not really getting any reward for it, and especially with Sisyphus because every time you get the ball to the top you earn 1 point.
Yeah.
And so the high score system there is very clear. Whoever has the high score above me has done this 12 times or has done this 30 times. Like, it's very tangible. You can see exactly how many attempts were made, and when you do it once and you realize you have to do it 12 more times to break third place.
Mm-hmm.
You go, I'm not sure I really want to do this, because it takes 5 minutes to get the ball up once, so
yeah.
It's like, okay, I'm going to be here for another hour trying to do this. I think people just give up right away. And with Rags, it's the same thing. There's like, oh, okay, I can't collect the coins, I'm done. But with the other games I made, I found that people were spending a lot more time with them.
The Euclid one.
The Euclid one, definitely, because it became clear that for the people playing it, it became clear that I just have to get better at this.
Mm-hmm.
And if I get better at it, I will break the high score eventually. But, I'm not there yet. And so that was the kind of desire. I think people had a desire then to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But there still is
an element of futility in that you can't beat it.
Right, and that it's incredibly difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So it's people would their first round, I can only last for 23 seconds. Their next round was 30. And so it was, they were getting there, but the high score was still at 4 minutes. So it would have been,
mm-hmm.
would have taken them forever. And then I did two other games for the thesis, graduate thesis show. One was called Detris, so it was basically just a Tetris clone.
Mm-hmm.
Where the goal of play was to earn money for every 5 minutes that you were playing to work towards my student loan debt. And then the other one was called Peer Pressure, which was the name of the show, the thesis show, and was basically a fighting game with the characters of the thesis show as the players. So those two games were, I think, the most successful and most widely played because, well, for one thing, Tetris, I think, is just... That was already proven to be a good game,
Was the gameplay actually Tetris?
It was exactly identical. I didn't really change anything. I just swapped some of the graphics around. I changed the color of the Tetris pieces to these abject, kind of disgusting bodily fluid color colors, and... really just changed around all the spots on the screen that would have contained information about Tetris and made them about, how much money you had earned and how much you had left to go and,
mm-hmm.
How much time you had left on your productivity assessment clock before you got, you made your earnings.
Was there a starting total that was your actual student loan debt that they were just trying to reduce to zero,
yep.
essentially?
Yeah, it was a rough estimation of what I kind of understood myself to owe. I think it was around 90,000 or something.
Wow.
Like that. Yeah, and if you played the game on easy difficulty, you were essentially this museum curator who earned $50 an hour,
mm-hmm.
and every time you cleared a Tetris line, you I think you earned 45 cents towards the total. If you played the game on hard...
So it'd take you years, literally,
yeah,
to beat it.
Well,
right?
with as being a museum curator, I think you could beat it pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, and that was the easy mode. If you were playing it on hard, you were earning federal minimum wage, which
okay.
was $7.30 or $7.25 an hour. And you earn 3 cents per line clear. So, you know, with that, a lot of people played it on easy.
Mm-hmm.
No one really felt like they wanted to play it on hard, which unfortunately is not how the world works. A lot of people have to play Tetris in the real world on hard, but
mm-hmm.
You know, I gave the option to people, and you know, they just played it. And at the end of the day, for the run of the show, the amount of money earned was, I think, around $150.
Mm-hmm.
So that was about a month. So it was very clear that this game would have to be on display for the next, I don't know, 20 years before that
mm-hmm.
amount of money is would ever have been paid off.
Most people don't have what it takes to pay off the debt.
Exactly. even in this case, fictitiously and digitally, people
mm-hmm.
just didn't want to work at it. But I think the idea there was that, you know, I mean, this is a collective effort, and that I can't do this by myself. And it's not to say that I want money from people, but that the idea is that, like, you know, working towards the future requires...
Mm-hmm.
you know, group help. And
did it actually collect quarters that help pay your debt?
No, that was a suggestion that people had. They were, you know, they were saying, well, why don't you, you know, make the games a quarter to play? And I was like, well, I don't really know how to, like, rig up one of those quarter systems. And they were like, that doesn't mean you actually have to rig it up, just put a hole in the machine.
Yeah.
And people will put quarters in and that'll be enough. But I never got around to it. But yeah, so the last game was Peer Pressure, and that was essentially, yeah, just a fighting game where we would all, you know, we were fighting, and it kind of started out as a fighting game based on, like, Street Fighter or something like that, but it
mm-hmm.
quickly became, in terms of gameplay, a Super Smash Brothers Melee.
So it was, like, multiple characters jumping in at once?
Well, it was a two-player game, but the goal was to knock the other player off the map instead of, where with, like, Street Fighter, it would have been to get the health bar down, and...
Mm-hmm.
With Super Smash Brothers, and the game was a lot like Super Smash Brothers in content too, where, you know, these 8 different people with their own worlds and their own minds get together and fight in this like art world arenas. So I had, like,
mm-hmm.
the classroom, the gallery, the ivory tower was one of the arenas, and then I had areas from my other games. So I had the Rags Wasteland was an area you could fight in, and the Void was an area you could fight in. A lot like the you know, if you've never played Super Smash Brothers, it's basically a kind of Nintendo All-Stars fighting game where, you know, you can play as any Nintendo character, and you can fight in any kind of Nintendo world that has been created over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured Peer Pressure would be just like that, where, yeah, so it's basically these artists fighting in these art world scenarios.
Were they all, like, famous, recognizable artists you could pick to fight with?
No, it was everybody in the show. So it was all
okay.
my friends. So so it was actually not really... It could have been that,
mm-hmm.
and it might eventually become that, but for now, it's kind of in its beta release.
Mm-hmm.
It was just my friends and I in the show.
Mm.
So that's what I have completed right now.
What upcoming games do you have coming out?
So what I think I'm working on for the future is games that are incredibly tailored to the person that I'm making them for. So I decided that I'm going to make games that, you know, everyone can play, but the reason they're being made it is as gifts to specific individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I work at the ICA in Boston, and I, you know, I'm a visitor assistant, and we you know, there are a lot of us, and so every once in a while we need shifts covered and stuff. And when we, you know, one of the things that goes on there is that, you know, people need bathroom breaks, and so when they do is they call over the radio, I need a code blue. So I was like, oh, well,
why is that
sounds
code
like
yellow?
A really, well, yeah, good question. I don't know. And so when I got to thinking about it, I was like, wow, that would make a really good title for a game, Code Blue.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I wasn't really sure how I would, you know, why would I make this game? What's the reason? Like, other than making a kind of game about my job, I was like, well, why don't I make these games for people when I ask for coverage when I asked for one of my shifts to get covered. So, I started promising people at the job, if you cover my shift, I will make you a custom tailored video game. And so I've just basically been working on that lately. Mm. I've got two people who are in line for one, and in August I'm probably going to need more time off, so I'm going to be promising more games. But
how long would it take to make one of these?
How long does it take to make one of these games? Mm. If I work on it, if I work fully and focus completely on it, I could probably, probably takes about 4 or 5 full days of work to get one of these things finished.
That's a large commitment for
one day of work. It is. But at the same time, I'm making these things for people.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really, also making them as an artist. So I will, I'm showing them to, people as this is what I've done. So
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a double thing. Like, I'm working for my, my own experience and making something. But I'm also giving somebody something that only they really truly understand.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that that's cool. Like, people... One of my advisors was saying, she really doesn't understand why most video games are about these shell characters who everyone can enter into. She was finding that to be problematic, that you can't really make a game about nothing and try to, make that person who's playing it feel completely a part of it. It has to be about believable character. It has to be about idiosyncrasies of like an individual. And so she was really adamant that I... think about that, and I have, and I think that it's true. Like, I've always found that, like, personal stories and things like that are actually more about everyone's story and become about everybody's story, and so I think
mm-hmm.
they're easier, actually end up being easier to relate to in the end.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much the update as,
mm-hmm.
as of today. That's what I'm working on right now.
So what kind of concepts do you have for these specific people for the games?
That's a good question. Yeah. So, the one game that I'm working on right now, the first one of this series is, for a person who has in the past made jokes about, she always has like Jolly Ranchers in her boot and she eats those to kind of pass the time. And she's made jokes about the kids running around in the museum. So I took those components, and then I've taken some of the pieces that are on display right now, and I've thought, well, how can these things be video games? And so what I'm working on right now is basically a simple game in which, you're given 30 hours to play the game, or, I mean, not 30 hours, 30 minutes, sorry. you're given 30 minutes to play the game, and you have to basically survive for 30 minutes. And 30 minutes is how long one of our rotations lasts on our shift. So every 30 minutes, we go to a different room. And the idea is that, after 30 minutes, you get your code blue. So with her, I've just had it. So she's going to be dangling a Jolly Rancher on a stick in front of 3 pieces of artwork that she can't allow to be damaged by running children. We saw a child on a leash once while we were there, and we everyone was laughing because it's not something you see.
Kids.
Yeah, the poor leash kids. You don't see that every day. And when it does happen, it's like kind of jarring because it's like, it's kind of what people do to their animals, but I wouldn't expect that their child, and especially not in a museum. But at the same time, it's like, as a guard, as a VA, it's like, it's kind of cool that they're on a leash because they're not worried about whether or not they're going to run into the work.
Yeah.
So the idea, and we were, when we saw this, her and I were actually laughing about it. So it ends up, this is now kind of the content of the game, where these children on leashes have broken free and are running towards pieces, and she has to get the Jolly Rancher in front of their face before they hit the work.
Mm-hmm. Which pieces did you have selected? I was just there like 2 days ago.
Yeah, so it's all 3 of Tara Donovan's pin, cube pieces. Have you seen the pin cube?
Yeah, I did. That's what I was thinking, because it's got no adhesive or anything.
Exactly,
it's
super fragile. And I've heard stories of children running right into it before. Yeah. So she also has 2 other ones. She has one made out of toothpicks, and she has one made out of glass.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put those in the game, and basically they'll get damaged as the game goes on, but the idea is that they have to make it through at least somewhat intact for half an hour. And all the while, Jack Lemmon, the Rachel Harrison piece that's there with this little mannequin who's holding a like a butterfly net with a lemon in it.
Mm-hmm.
Who's this like Giannis figure from like Greek myth with like, you know, it's Jack Lemon over this mannequin face, and on the other side is this woman. And so this is two-headed figure, and it's going to be throwing lemons at the player, and she's going to have to try to avoid being hit by them. If she is hit by them, she will be impaired for a short amount of time and won't be able to protect the arc.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is like, it's coming at from, you know, it's coming at it from every angle. And
yeah,
you know, this is definitely, I'm starting to make them more like games for sure. I think that's something else that I'm trying to do with this, is to actually make them fun to play, whereas before they were meaningless.
The point was to
futile.
Like frustrate
the, yeah, the point was
user.
To frustrate it, frustrate the player. And so yeah, I think that you know, and I want to make, but one of the other comments that was made to me was, you know, what would the video game that you made specifically for your grandmother be like?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really profound question. It's like, how would I, you know, relate something like this to somebody who's of a generation who doesn't identify with this work?
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's so easy to identify with because this is what I've grown up with. This is what I've been doing for most of my life, is consuming these things. Whereas my grandmother, I mean, she plays Free Cell, you know, on her laptop, but that's it. She doesn't really
mm-hmm.
engage, and she's seen me play video games my whole life, but, you know, is only really interested in the content of the stories. And so I was thinking about, you know, what would it mean to try to make something that she would enjoy? And I still haven't figured that out, but that's, you know, that's something that I'm thinking about on the horizon for sure.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything beyond the style that draws you to the style of video game they're using, which is like kind of early 8-bit
okay.
Nintendo? Because I've seen some other pieces on your website that are more like Flash based, I guess, and you could go like much more realistic
right.
route with them, or like,
I have thought about that, but personally the stylistic thing is, well, it comes from two places. I think it comes from a simplicity of production. Like, I really like just being able to make quickly.
Mm.
And so the graphics are really easy to draw. You know, I can get in Photoshop and zoom all the way in and like just work pixel to pixel. And then from a coding standpoint, like, I really don't understand how to make 3D games yet.
Mm-hmm.
Or anything like that. And while I certainly would like to, I'm not quite sure how to enter into it conceptually. I think that there's something to be said for this kind of just two-dimensional immersion. I've always thought that, while I would, you know, even if I did make a 3D game, it would not be immersive. Like, I just wouldn't,
yeah.
you know, I wouldn't be able mm-hmm. to get there unless I had, you know, a movie-sized team of people helping me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, it allows for a little bit of you know, part on the viewer to fill in the gaps as to what they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are kind of the two reasons why I do it. And that, and I, you know, it's I guess the third and maybe, you know, more personal reason is it's just a kind of nostalgia thing for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I just really enjoy seeing that, you know, those pixels moving across the screen in a very rudimentary way.
Yeah.
So.
How would you prefer that people interact with these? Is it something that you envision being out in the public sphere, like at a store or something, where you might actually see an arcade machine, or do you view it as something that belongs in a gallery?
I desire that it be all of those things. I think that I want certain pieces to be in museum, or in, not museums, sorry, in galleries.
Everybody would love this.
Yeah,
stuff
everyone would
in
like
their
work in a museum. no, you know, I really want, you know, some of these things, like when I made the Into the Void game with Eve Klein, like that was specifically designed for a gallery setting. It was a kind of about galleries. It was about the void space. It was about trying to make sense of nothingness in that, you know, in those spaces of putting art in these supposed rooms of flattened meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so I would want, you know, I would want to make games for that context. And at the same time, like, I really, really want these things to be seen by as many people as possible. I think that that's kind of the point of it, you know, essential communication about concepts that we all understand. And so I think the internet, of course, is the other logical step for that. And I and then on the other hand, I haven't really even considered what it would mean to find, you know, games like this in a kind of, I don't know how to put it, in, you know, like a CD based, like where, oh yeah, I just found a copy of this game.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, that's another possible avenue. But, you know, that's, that idea is predicated on the logic of the video game home console system.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I wouldn't, you know, I'm not making games for that audience. I can't really make games for that audience right now.
I was going to say, would it be possible to reprogram like an 8-bit Nintendo cartridge to contain your game? So
absolutely, it would be.
Yeah,
it would be. I think, you know, you could probably flash the and overwrite the ROM file that's already on the game, and, you know, edit the contents of it. And that would actually be really cool.
But I can make a label for it.
Exactly, and yeah,
relabel
it. Yeah, that's something that I would definitely be a more ambitious project. Would require, I think, me to relearn everything I know about making the game and actually just working with somebody else's existing, I don't know, you know, the whole existing code and the visual assets and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I've seen these things online, but they're only ever really made for, like, people running their own emulators on their computers.
Mm-hmm.
If I could make it and flash the cart and say, hey, if you still have an NES from the 80s, like, you know, here's the game I made. You know, and of course, I've seen you know, there's, like, Corey Archangel's piece where he's, you know, edited and manipulated the Super Mario Brothers cart so that it's just like the clouds moving across the screen and stuff like that, and that
mm-hmm.
can certainly be done too, but the interactivity is not really there in that case. It's really just about seeing something being manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think the context specificity of the actual game and the content is what would drive where that game ends up being shown, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I guess he could also get really old with it and turn it into an Atari game.
Yeah.
Those would be simpler to monkey with, probably.
Probably. And I think, you know, at this point, there's one of the artists, Pippin Bar, I think, is he did the kind of recreation of Marina Abramovich's The Artist is Present performance at MoMA, where he made it basically an 8-bit, or not even 8-bit, an Atari game.
Mm-hmm.
Of this experience, and all of the games I've seen this person, this artist make, have that Atari aesthetic, very, very simple. And I wonder if it's actually easier to recreate that style than it is to go back and try to make one of those games and distribute it for that system.
Mm. Are there many other people that work in video game motifs?
Well, as far as some of my influences, I definitely, you know, I really did like and enjoy the work of Pippin Bar. He actually has a game about, he has a game which contains the Sisyphus myth in the same exact setup. But then he also, he's outdone me for 5 times over, where he has, you know, everybody, all these other myths. So he has Prometheus, where you have to wiggle to get the crows from picking at your intestines and stuff like that. And then, you know, in that same game, there are 4 other, you know, myth characters who you have to play as, and it's the same concept, but the execution is just spotless, and it's great. And so there's somebody that I definitely look up to and I'm very interested in. And then there are people, there are, you know, there's Mall Industria who make, you know, they've made like this McDonald's game where you have to, like, you know, use GMO soy and like destroy indigenous people's homes in areas to make your french fries more productive and all these things. So I definitely, you know, I'm influenced by these artists who are making games about social things or about, you know, other artworks. But at the end of the day, like, I'm also just a video gamer, so I'm really interested in indie developers who are making games. Like, you know, there's the game Minecraft, which definitely sparked my interest in making my own games.
What is that one exactly? Is that the one where you kind of create whatever you want?
Exactly, yeah. It's this kind of, like, Lego simulator where, like, you can, you know, you start in this giant world. This world that is, I guess, conceivably 8 times larger than the Earth if you were to try to walk it. You're given no task other than to basically survive these zombies and skeletons and stuff. But in the meantime, you know, you can build yourself a home, you can farm and do all these other things. And it's really, you know, I always see this kind of existential commentary in these things where, like, you know, you're given this task of basically creation in mm-hmm. this infinite world, and there's no point other than to just kind of survive. And so there's things like that that I'm definitely looking in. And aside from that, it's just a really addicting game. You know, and there's other game, you know, other people are making games which I think I'm just more, you know, influenced by stylistically. There's the this game called Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery EP, which is essentially just a video game that's a riff on the idea of a band putting out an EP. So it's this really short game, and you kind of, you know, you play on side A and you play on side B, and mm-hmm. and, like, you know, but it's this really simple 8-bit aesthetic, but it's just gorgeous. It's just a beautiful game, and it's this kind of point and click adventure. And there's really nothing to it. Like, you don't get better at it. You just have to figure out how to work your way through the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are people like that. Aside from that, I just think that generally the video game industry is definitely a huge influence, and I think that it's maturing. And I think that I'm just watching it to see where it goes, because I think that it's growing up, and it's not necessarily about shooting and killing it, as many people as you can anymore. Yeah. It's starting to become about other things. And yet at the same time retaining its kind of blockbuster scale. And I think that that's really interesting.
So in your new stuff, would you say that you're moving away from the idea of kind of futility that's in the Sisyphus game
mm-hmm.
and things, and I guess what kind of drew you to dwelling on that topic in the earlier ones, and why are you getting away from that?
Well, definitely in the earlier games I was trying to get away from a very, like, I had a huge existential crisis right before I was making the games, and I think that's why Sisyphus worked right when it did, was because I didn't know what to do. I was kind of just like, oh, I don't really know what to make.
Mm-hmm.
I can make anything I want as an artist. I really don't have any limitations. So this big, huge why was hovering over my head. Like, why? Why? You know, if I can do anything, why do anything? And so that question...
You just happened to read that Camus book.
Exactly.
At the same time.
I just happened to be reading that at the same time. And so those questions were being compounded further. But Camus was trying to get me out of that. You know, I could tell in the text that was his point. It's like, make, create. Get out of this, like, idea that, like, just because you know you can do anything, why do anything? It's kind of that, like, end game scenario that you can't allow yourself to get stuck in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, this thing comes along, this ability to write code and program, and I'm thinking, wow, I need to relate what I was feeling, you know, last year into a handful of video games. And so that's exactly why the futility was there. And, you know, at the same time, I'm not a game designer. I'm not a logics designer. I don't know how to code the logic of what makes a video game fun, but I've only now been researching that and playing a ton of them just to figure out exactly what keeps me coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I think, why I'm starting to get away from the futility thing, is because now there's enough misery and suffering, there's enough, like, sad faces, you know, I think that I want to see how I can now maybe show people things that they're uncomfortable with, or make people question things, but also give them something fun at the same time. That still, you know, maybe can retain some of that futility and some of that inherent participator as performer ideology that I was working with before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all those things kind of combine, hopefully, to create things that are, yeah, maybe a little bit more ambitious, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I referenced some of your works online that are kind of Java-based, not even games necessarily, but, like, activities.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At what point were those made, and what were you
those
dealing
are
with
made
in those?
As exercises, for sure, in trying to get better at some of the coding aspects that I needed to learn. But, you know, during my time during school, I always found that assignments weren't necessarily about removing yourself from what you're doing in general, and maybe about, like, adapting what you're doing to the assignment. And so I was just, you know, I was taking these assignments and basically trying to make my own art with them. And so, the, you know, I had, you know, I had a, assignment where I had to make 7 pieces in 7 days. Mm. You know, 7 game, you know, not games, but 7 interactive programs in 7 days. And, you know, it was really tough, but I ended up really enjoying the project, and so I found a lot of the works that I made out of it just to be interesting, and I wanted to put them up. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things on my website have just stayed up because I think they're cool, but not because I want to necessarily, I don't know, say that they have any bigger meaning. Mm-hmm. It was just like, oh wow, this is, you know, I've seen interactive websites before, but I didn't realize that I could make them, so I've made a few here. Check them out.
Mm-hmm. I thought the one called Blood was very interesting. How did you come up with the idea for that?
Oh yeah,
one?
That one. That one's actually a recreation of Felix Gonzalez Torres' piece.
Really?
That was at the ICA at the time. And I, you know, secretly, I kind of made that for everybody who worked at the ICA. So I tried to make this kind of internal viral thing where I showed it to all of the people I work with, and then I also emailed it to some of the people that are higher up, like the curators and stuff. And you know, it was fun. It was a piece that was up during.
Was it an actual video interactive piece that was up?
Yeah, it was a so the last show that they had up was called Figuring Color. And it contained a piece by Felix Gonzalez Torres called Untitled Blood, just like the game I made, or whatever it is, the interactive piece I made. And it was this long bead curtain that spanned the width of the museum, or at least that room of the museum. And it was designed to be walked through and interacted with.
Mm-hmm.
And so people would walk through it, they would run their hands down the beads, the length of the beads, and it would create this cascading effect. It was, you know, a really interesting piece. It had, you know, a nice kind of soothing noise to it when people walked through it. But it was also, you know, it's a Felix Gonzalez Torres piece called Blood, so I'm, you know, it's also this kind of intense piece about, you know, AIDS and things like that, and about dealing with, you know, fear of infection and you know, things that were and still are, I think, pretty pertinent things to consider. And but at the end of the day too, it was this piece in the museum where people are allowed to touch it, and
mm-hmm.
that just doesn't happen often. And so it was this wonderful experience for kids, and at the same time, as you know, a VA guard there, I was also just always afraid the piece was going to get destroyed. And so I edited somebody else's code that, you know, was this piece of fabric, and I turned it into a kind of recreation of this this piece on display that could be totally destroyed,
mm-hmm.
totally played with, and however anyone wanted to. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like, people who work at a museum, I think, are experiencing the work in a different way than the viewers
yeah.
who just come to visit. And you know, there's a lot of anxiety that starts to build up, and you're like, oh man, I hope that piece doesn't get destroyed. But secretly, everybody might also really want to see that piece get destroyed. So it's another piece of, like, stress relief for the,
yeah.
like, yeah, here you go, now you can destroy it in this kind of safe, harmless way. So, yeah, that was why I made that. I tried to make, actually, a recreation of the pin cube, too, the Tara Donovan pin cube, for that same reason. Like, here's a piece that is so precious that you can't, even get near what would happen if I made a kind of digital recreation of it that could just be completely demolished. But it's just too complicated a structure that I couldn't figure out how to do it. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And so I guess just one last question for you. What's your favorite 8-bit Nintendo game?
Oh, man.
And would you try to fit that into a piece somewhere
oh,
in the future?
Yeah. It's definitely, I think, Zelda. The
yeah.
first Zelda game.
That's a popular favorite.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's one of the Zelda is a Nintendo franchise that I've just basically followed my whole life. And
I guess how would you sum up, like, what makes that a solid game? Because everybody has that
brutally difficult. I mean, it's just
you
so
like the difficulty
difficult.
Of it.
I like the difficulty of it, and I like the way that it gives you nothing. It basically gives you absolutely nothing to go on. You're dropped in the world, just like in, you know, something like Minecraft, and you basically have to figure it out. And there's very little prompt. And I think video games have definitely strayed away from that. There's too much of a concern
yeah.
that the player is not going to understand it, and they're going to stop playing immediately.
Yeah, that is true, because I never even beat the original one.
Right.
I got to the end, and I couldn't
yeah,
beat Ganon, but
right.
it doesn't... You doesn't really give you any instruction on what to do or where to go.
He gives you nothing, and then when you do get some instruction or some hints, they're incredibly obtuse.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have no idea what... Okay, so I'm supposed to talk to the old lady over there, but, like, I don't know how to get there, and
yeah.
you know, all these other things, so...
And then in the new ones, like, they spell everything
yeah.
out in tutorial levels for you.
Yeah, the first hour of play is generally tutorial-based, and everything is covered.
Mm-hmm.
And no, there are no stone left unturned in terms of how you're meant to interact with the world. And I think that totally kills some of the wonder and some of the reasons that you would play the game. I've recently heard it referred to as having essentially a giant key ring with every key you need to beat the game. And basically, you just have to figure out which key goes in which door.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only recently become a case where the game basically tells you what the next key is going to be. You just have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, you still had that key ring, but you had no idea where you were even supposed to start looking for the doors.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really do want to make an adventure game along those lines. Something super hardcore, something really difficult, but something that, I don't know, kind of captures that imagination of like, exploration. So,
mm-hmm.
So Zelda is definitely one of my all-time favorites. And I didn't even play it when I was a kid. I only played it later in life and realized what I had missed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it came out the same year I was born, so I think that
mm-hmm.
I kind of missed the boat in terms of getting to play with it when I would have been that age.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Zelda game Ocarina of Time was actually my first Zelda experience, and it still had, I think, the same effect on me that I think younger generations would have had,
mm-hmm.
or older generations, sorry, would have had with the first Zelda game. So yeah, I think an adventure game is definitely in the works in the future.
Nice. Look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for talking with me today.
Absolutely.
See your work around in the future, hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest, Anthony Montori. You can find his work online at anthonymontori.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, madcoolman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee that I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.